From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Oren Durell, Foreign Affairs reporter for USA Today. And here are the issues. A coalition led by Saudi Arabia has attacked the Houthi insurgents in Yemen, who are backed by Iran, in an effort to oust them and restore the previous pro-Saudi government. Egypt has joined the coalition, which is backed by the United States. In Switzerland, a deadline for a deal to curb Iran's nuclear program is imminent. And an American soldier held by the Taliban in Afghanistan in exchange for five captured Taliban commanders was charged with desertion and misbehavior. David Rennie, I'm going to start with you. There are two words that have popped up immediately in this, what's going on in Yemen, usually not one of the places that we're focusing on most in the world, but you have the Saudis and the Egyptians, and then you have the Iranians, and the words that pop up are proxy war. Is this a proxy war?
Well, we better hope it's not a full-scale proxy war between the Sunni world and the Shia world, because I think that that's what really concerns people here in Washington, is
Indeed.
That if you look across the map, you know, we in the media have a habit of saying, you know, what's the news from Syria? What's the news from Yemen? Mm-hmm. What's the news from Iraq? But on the ground, there's a different mental map emerging of a kind of generational clash between, a once-in-a-generation clash between the Sunni world and the Shia world. And it's breaking out all over. And America really does not want to be dragged into that fight. And this then points to a major dilemma for America, that they had this Pax Americana for decades in the Middle East by basically siding with the autocrats of the Sunni world. So the Gulf monarchies, the Egyptians, with their nationalist leadership. And that was stable, if often unpleasant. Now, in the midst of negotiations with the great Shiite regional superpower, Iran, on its nuclear arsenal, all of these pieces are in chaos. And so we find ourselves rooting for Shiites with Iranian help when they're taking on the Islamic State in Iraq and in Syria. We find ourselves worrying about the Iranians helping Shiite rebels in Yemen and rooting for the Sunni Gulf monarchies as their air force bombs these targets. And America, you know, finds itself pulled in every which direction. But as you say, proxy war is the scary thing, that there is an overarching template, which is a conflict which on the ground is seen as Sunni versus Shia, a sectarian, once in a sort of generational fight. And America really does not want to be dragged into that.
Well, America's dragged in a bit, backing that Saudi coalition, not sending troops, but providing intelligence, Oren. That's probably more than President Obama would have wanted to do, and yet he's done it. What's your take about this on it being a proxy war? And an even bigger question here in the United States is, does the Obama administration have a coherent policy, and even is a coherent policy possible?
I think the thing to remember in Yemen, a lot of people who have been following Yemen for a long time will say, well, this is a conflict that's been simmering for a long time. The Houthis have fought three wars against the Yemeni government. They have legitimate grievances. They're independent, they're very independent people. And they don't necessarily do what the Iranians tell them to do, even though there's evidence that the Iranians have been giving them support. The Saudis would like to paint this as a conflict with Iran. But Yemen is also to the United States, Yemen is important in part because there's a very active Al-Qaeda affiliate, AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is down there. They're the ones that tried to send multiple bombs and through freight airplanes, and the underwear bomber came from there. Mm-hmm. And there have been a bunch of different plots that came out of AQAP. So the Obama administration's policy towards Yemen has been a counterterrorism policy focused on AQAP and, while supporting the local government. And all of that has – now the American troops have left Yemen, and – The policy seems to be a little bit in tatters. They are supporting the Saudis in their effort to get the previous government back in power. But I think we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah, David, this is a place where the Obama administration has claimed, and I think still does, that this is where their counterterrorism policy had really worked. I'm referring to Yemen.
The president used the word model, I think, to describe Yemen, because you not only had special forces based in Yemen attacking the Sunni extremists of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. You also had a drone base just over the border in Saudi Arabia, which was doing these very intensive drone strikes. There was a lot of cooperation on the ground. Now, of course, everything is up in the air because the Americans have had to leave. You now have that Sunni-Shia calculation, you know, becoming even more complicated. I think it's also important, just in case it's not complex enough for listeners, to make the point that this isn't just a Houthi insurgency of kind of tribal insurgents. Mm-hmm. There is also another dynamic here, which is that the former longtime autocratic president of Yemen, former President Saleh, he has military units still loyal to him, and they are fighting too. I mean, that's why we're seeing Yemeni airplanes attacking targets in Yemen. I mean, the Houthis are not flying these planes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there is, you know, to add to the complexity here, there are also elements of an old autocratic regime trying to get back into power in alliance with the Houthis.
What do you make of American policy?
I think that my basic problem with the debate we have in Washington is that, I mean, look, debate in a political system like this is never going to be a Socratic dialogue where we're trying to kind of identify a kind of ideal policy.
That's putting it mildly.
But nonetheless, there is, you know, there's a problem I have, which is that there are many legitimate criticisms to be made about the Obama administration's handling of foreign policy. You know, they have made predictions which didn't come true. Mm. They have placed bets which now look like bad bets. So there's all sorts of legitimate reasons to criticize.
They did make a bet on Yemen.
That's true. But there is also an element of extremely sort of simplistic gotcha criticism from the Republicans, which is to say the world is in a mess. It feels unsafe. Americans feel very unsafe and very scared. And it's causal. Because the president took a more, you know, emollient tone with other countries, because he decided to use less military force and more diplomacy, that is why the world is in a mess. And I think that that is just as implausible as it was when President Obama won office in 2008 by saying that everything George Bush had done was the reason that the world was complex and in a mess. The problem with foreign policy is that you can think that your opponent's policy is dumb, promise to do the opposite, but sometimes in foreign policy, the opposite of dumb is not magnificently successful. It's just a different kind of dumb.
I like that emollient tone. I hadn't heard of the Obama.
Was that a euphemism?
No, it's just an interesting phrase. All right. Anyway, we'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Oren Durrell of USA Today and David Rennie of The Economist. And now, this program announcement.
Here's a quick quiz. What do the letters LTATONLAW stand for? We know the answer, right? Listen to Akwae Thompson on Nightline Africa weekends. Add to that 16 and 18 UTC on VOA, and we have a perfect score. That was easy.
We're back, Oren. And what's the way out here in Yemen? How does this thing end well?
I think we'll have to see. I'm sure that one of the things that we have to remember about the Obama administration is that this is an anti-war president. He doesn't believe that that the country can afford or is benefited by foreign military adventures. So I have a feeling that he's going to be seeking to end this. He also believes in foreign, coalitions of foreign countries solving problems regionally. There's a risk to that.
The coalition is bombing.
There's a very big risk to that because while you're letting other people do the fighting, you're also letting them sort of make their own decisions. And how this works out in Yemen is you know, we'll have to see.
Indeed we will. Here's my last question, David, and that is the support from the United States of the Saudi coalition, is really not necessary. I mean, obviously, the Saudis and the Egyptians have large armies and air forces. They can handle this on their own. Why did the Obama administration become a part of that coalition, at least behind the scenes?
Well, look, I'm not an Air Force kind of veteran. You know, another of our panelists, Tom DeFrank, would be much better to help us here. But,
indeed.
You know, the Saudis have a lot of kit, but that doesn't mean that they know exactly how to use it. They don't have a tremendous amount of experience. They buy very expensive American airplanes and expensive weapons, but they haven't had a tremendous track record. The only time that the Saudis have actually had a fighting war in Yemen before they basically got thumped, and that didn't go well for them. And, you know, America has unique capabilities with intelligence and targeting and satellites and all of those things. I think politically what's interesting is, if we believe the latest reporting, the Saudis and the other Gulf monarchies didn't actually consult the Americans until quite late in the day. So this was something that was definitely their idea. But I think there is also a sense that it's not just that President Obama is anti-war. He has a theory of the case that America, sort of constantly being the security guarantor in these conflicts, somehow infantilizes other countries, that there are times when it's just up to them to step up. If it matters to them enough, they need to step up. So it's absolutely right that America then loses a degree of control, I mean, substantial control.
Right.
But this is what he was kind of intending. You know, these are regional conflicts, and he wants to see regional solutions.
All right. We're going to turn to the Iranian nuclear program and the deal that's being worked out in Switzerland. A deadline comes on March 31st, just several days away, and that's one deadline. Then there's another one in the end of June when the interim deal expires. But, you know, we're really looking to a couple days from now to see what happens. What is going to happen, Oren? Or what should happen?
Well, I think everybody, I think a lot of people are hoping that there will be some kind of a deal. The question is whether it's going to be a deal that that's palatable here in Washington. And that is really the big question. There have been, you know, as we're getting close to this endpoint, there have been reports of various concessions that the Americans supposedly had made, such as allowing centrifuges to continue to spin, very advanced centrifuges. These are these machines that are used to separate, to process uranium into fuel. That can be used for either nuclear power plants or for medical isotopes or for bombs. The Iranians claim that they're not using them for bombs. But in any case, they're talking about allowing these centrifuges to continue to operate, but to spin not uranium but other substances. And critics are saying that means that they're continuing to do their R&D on nuclear work. The administration will say, no, they're not. And some people find it unacceptable. Then there's also these another concession is that the Iranians have said that they're not going to agree to snap inspections on their sites. They've also said that they want to answer all the questions about possible military dimensions of their program, which is historical issues with their nuclear program. And you know, there's been evidence that they've done nuclear weapons research. They want to answer all those questions after the sanctions are lifted, or most of the sanctions are lifted. And again, these are all things that people, a lot of people in Congress are saying that you can't, you know, that disagree with this approach and say that it's going giving the Iranians too much. John Kerry has been saying, something like, "Show me an alternative. What else can you do? What's the alternative to a deal of this shape?"
Well, they've said, of course, the administration has said, and all administrations would, that no deal is better than a bad deal. So the alternative is probably no deal.
The alternative is no deal, and I think the administration is also saying that you know, there are people in the administration who are also saying that that no deal means, they're saying it means war. Of course, there are people who don't believe that, because, you know, they're saying, well, no, you could go back to some other kind of negotiation, but there's this conflict of you know, they're afraid that that if they don't get a deal, that they'll be that they'll go back to allowing Iran to produce to march ahead with its program, and that eventually it'll end up being a military conflict.
Well, David, the Iranians do want one thing in particular, and that is they want to have the economic sanctions lifted as much as possible. up front rather than after this deal, if there is one, goes into effect. And the other thing I would point out is if the United States and other countries believed that the Iranians were just doing all this nuclear stuff for civilian purposes, then we wouldn't even be having these talks.
Sure. No, I think, you know, nobody thinks the Iranians are a nice government. Nobody thinks the Iranians are trustworthy. Nobody believes what they're saying about their nuclear program. And nobody believes that the Iranians will voluntarily sign up to the deal that we would like. So it's never going to, you know, there is no good deal on offer. It's a question of just how bad a bad deal are we going to get. And I think one of the problems with the rhetoric here in Washington is that quite a lot of Republicans have taken a position which sounds great on TV, which is essentially, if you boil it down, any deal that Iran can accept can't be worth having because they are so infinitely wicked and infinitely untrustworthy, and that unless you're imposing a deal that they dislike on them, you can't have any confidence in it. But then you have to explain how you would go about imposing a deal on Iran that it dislikes and what the mechanism of imposition would be. And there, you know, the critics of this negotiation don't have a very clear case to answer.
I mean, let me stop you there for a minute, David. I have to remind the listeners that this is Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me today are Orrin Durrell of USA Today and David Rennie of The Economist, who I interrupted mid-sentence, David. But first, before that, this announcement.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
Now, David, you will be permitted to complete your sentence plus more.
Thank you. So I think that this is the thing. Is if Republicans are saying, you know, by definition, any deal that Iran will accept willingly in any way is a bad deal, they have to explain. I mean, let's drill down on what a no deal would be, because I think there's this idea that somehow we could just carry on with the same sanctions, toughen up the sanctions and keep going. There's two gigantic problems with that. One is under the current sanctions regime, painful though it is, the Iranian nuclear program has leapt ahead in leaps and bounds. So it isn't working if you want to stop them developing their nuclear program. They're building new centrifuges all the time. So what we have right now isn't that sustainable. Then if you're saying, well, actually what we need to do is to crank up the sanctions still more, there's a problem, which is that this isn't just up to America. The sanctions only work if you stop other countries, particularly in places like Europe or in China, buying Iranian oil. And it hurts them not to have access to Iranian oil. It doesn't hurt America. America's full of oil at the moment, thanks to fracking. So the Americans are asking allies and other world powers to take pain for the cause of this negotiation, to not buy Iranian oil, which they would like to buy.
Well, they have up to now.
Well, here's the problem, that I think Congress is kind of contemptuous of the idea of allies, you know, having any interest in this. You know, their view is, you know, if we blow up these negotiations, fine, you know, doesn't matter. There aren't any moderates in Iran. I think they underestimate how important it is that if the Americans are seen as having blown up these negotiations, then what is to guarantee that on the day after, the others, the Europeans, the Russians, the Chinese, will still be at the table, willing to crank up the sanctions still more as Congress wants? I think Congress is always inclined to think of everything as bilateral between America and some other country, and to be very, very sort of uninterested in the interests of other countries.
There is this competition, if you will, between Iran and the United States to not be the one to be blamed for a deal collapsing, for the talks collapsing. And there are those in the Congress and also in the Middle East who are saying that the Americans are being a pushover, that they're not being strong enough, that they're dealing with expert negotiators and that they're being naive and that they're giving too many concessions. And these complaints go back to the interim deal that they're negotiating under. You know, which allows certain things that the Iranians will be able to keep a nuclear program, enrichment program to begin with, that some people say, you know, went too far to begin with. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to see what happens. But there's definitely the administration, the Obama administration is definitely trying to appear to be conciliatory, so that if things do fall apart. Mm-hmm. they won't be blamed for it.
I think they've achieved that, being conciliatory. Let's turn finally to the American soldier, Bergdahl. I'm drawing a blank on his first name.
Bo, who had
left his unit in Afghanistan and then was seized by the Taliban, imprisoned for 5 years, finally released, and President Obama had quite an event at the White House where he brought Bergdahl's parents in and said he was operating in trading five Taliban commanders for Bergdahl, operating under the principle of long-term American principle in war, and that is that we will leave no soldier on the battlefield. And now he's being charged as a deserter and has raised questions, David, about whether what the president was really trying to do was continue reducing the number of prisoners at Guantanamo prison in Cuba.
Well, it's been a roller coaster ride. So a few weeks before Bo Bergdahl was released, I was at the annual Vietnam Veterans Rolling Thunder with the motorcyclists who rolled through Washington. I went down to talk to them, and they have this obsession that there are prisoners of war still in Southeast Asia and stuff. They were talking about Bo Bergdahl. They had all these wristbands and flags and remember Bo, Sergeant Bergdahl, and they were saying Obama because he doesn't like America because he's a Muslim terrorist. He's left this wonderful soldier behind, Sergeant Bo. It's a shame, you know, denouncing President Obama. You had Republican members of Congress saying it was disgraceful that Bo Bergdahl had not been brought home, that Obama was a very, very bad man. And then I think what actually went wrong was, if you ask me, part of the problem was that when we saw the father come out on TV at the White House, he had a long Muslim-style beard and long hair and started using Muslim prayer sort of phrases from the Quran.
But they also heard from the fellow soldiers who'd been with Bergdahl.
Sure, but what really went wrong was that when the father appeared on TV, he looked like a Muslim. And some parts of conservative America went, good God, that man is a Muslim. And that was it. Everything flipped on its head, and members of Congress started deleting their previous tweets about free Bo Bergdahl.
Don't underestimate the role of his fellow soldiers who all said he was a deserter.
Do you know what I think is really going on? I think it's not really about Guantanamo. I think the real problem is that we have not briefed the American public that as the Afghan war ends, the Taliban will be part of the peace talks. The idea that the Taliban are not, in fact, considered terrorists by America. They are enemy combatants, that they will be part of the final negotiations. America has not really hauled that in. That's why they're as offended as they are by this deal.
Warren, we have about a minute left, and it's yours.
Well, so, first of all, Bo Bergdahl, he apparently had problems with the war. He had personal issues with the mission that he was involved in. He apparently, walked into the enemy camp. That said, he is an American. He was an American soldier on the battlefield, and the Obama administration wanted to, even if he had his faults, they wanted to deal with that on U.S. soil. I think that part of the issue here, and this is kind of goes across all the elements of what we've been talking about, is the Obama administration's not doing such a great job, maybe, of communicating to the American public about foreign policy. It's really more focused on domestic policy. And when it comes to foreign policy, I think that there's a little bit to be desired in terms of communication to the public.
Well, David, you'd probably agree with that.
Yeah, and I think, when you're trying to talk to the military community, which is a very conservative community, they have a tin ear. They don't get it instinctively.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's all the time we have today. Join us. We're David Rennie, who you just heard, the Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Justin Thwaites and Nick Ivanov. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.